You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome back to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast with myself, Owen Walker. In this episode, we're going to have a replay of probably what is the most downloaded episode of the whole podcast. So just for some context, the podcast has been going for about 4.5 years now. Started it in late 2018. It's currently receiving about 163,000 downloads. Listened to in over 100 countries, and it's had some fantastic engagements just across the spectrum, really. It's been a real journey for me, just learning how to steward conversations, ask questions properly, and indeed just arrive at some really good education outputs as well. But it's always been a passion project of mine, and it's certainly given back to me in other ways. But this episode is one I recorded, gosh, it's got to be probably early 2019, actually, with Steve Rashford. Steve is the medical director, is and was the medical director of Queensland Ambulance Service. They've got circa 5,000 staff, operate about 1,300 vehicles, cover a large area, so the whole of Queensland. But we're more, in this conversation, we're focused on the HARU, so the High Acuity Response Unit. So I think the reason this is probably the most downloaded episode is that Steve just comes out with some absolute pearls of wisdom in the episode. He really mentions some fantastic points about how he tackles and approaches pre-hospital care. Some of these senior peer-to-peer relationships and indeed peer-to-peer conversations which occur on scene, sort of a 30-second S-bar and situation update. And he also just talked about how he approaches clinical governance as well. And they have the hot debrief, the cold debrief, and then they go on for a further debrief as well. So case review, cold and hot, and then they have a further measured debrief as well. And it's just a fantastic episode from multiple areas, really. But just the way they do clinical governance, the way they do this senior conversation on scene, straight out of the gate, just to make sure they're not missing anything. And just some real pearls of wisdom across the conversation. So listen, I hope you do enjoy. We'll be back next week with more content. We've got some fantastic content on performance with Steve Hearns. I'm also going to be speaking with the Advanced Paramedic Scheme within London Ambulance Service, so the Urgent Care Scheme, just see how they approach urgent care in the contemporary climate. We're also going to be speaking with a number of different clinicians around their journey into pre-hospital care. So I'm going to be speaking with Vicky Brown, who's a Band 8 Fellow in Immediate Medical Care, and just talking to her about how she's got to become sort of top of the tree within the critical care sphere, and indeed her journey along the way, and some of the compounding learning that she's brought with her. So we're going to have a few of these inspirational stories, dig into a few of the schemes, and indeed look at performance from a different lens as well. We're also going to look at bleeding. So we're going to look at fibrinogen concentrate versus cryoprecipitate, look at both the profile and indeed the utility, and look at some of the empirical evidence as well. So lots of good stuff to come. So please do enjoy this most downloaded episode with Steve Rashford. Please do forgive my shoddy interview technique. Hopefully I did get better, have got better over the past few years. But please do enjoy. I'm always willing to accept feedback for the podcast. I will put my email on the bottom of this release. And please do feel free to reach out. Okay, thanks guys.
Hi, so welcome guys to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast with me, Owen Walker. So today I've got a friend, colleague and legend, Steve Rashford with me. How are you, Steve?
I'm good, thanks, Alan. All from the other side of the planet, but I think I'm not sure about the legend bit, but certainly a friend.
Yeah. Steve, I just wondered if you could just introduce yourself just for listeners, if that's okay.
Great. Yeah, no, I'm an emergency physician. I've been practicing for nearly 30 years now, and I'm very lucky to be the medical director for the Queensland Ambulance Service, which is, we've got about 4,000 registered paramedics and a number of other operational staff in the operational centres and the like. It's a fairly busy service, and I've been the medical director for nearly 15 years or maybe a little bit longer for that service, and I think it's the best job in the world.
Fantastic. Fantastic, Steve. Fantastic. So is the majority of your career, Steve, pre-hospital or was it in hospital?
I know. Well, a combination. I'm an emergency medicine specialist. So, but I started flying around in helicopters in 1993 and sort of on and off over the subsequent years. Pretty much always had some finger in the pie with paramedical retrieval and pre-hospital care, and probably from about 2005 concentrated on pure out-of-hospital care in terms of the ambulance service and the like. So I don't know, I've flown really in the last 10 years, I must admit, I've been around the skies of the UK, both in Kent, Surrey, Sussex, and most recently with London Hems, London's Air Ambulance. In 2016-17. So
that's fantastic. Yes. So that just loops me in actually quite nicely, because we've done a few jobs together actually. One in particular I remember was a fatal RTC, I think, up in North London. You'll have been to so many you might not remember it, but I certainly remember just this pervasive calmness that ushers in when you got there, and we just nice and calmly sorted out the scene and just went through the steps. But it's certainly been quite a while, actually. So that must have been 2016-17 when you were last here.
Yeah. Well, I must have got me on a good day. But it was a good time. I really enjoyed it. I learned a lot. It's always great to visit other systems. I think you can get stale. Every 4 or 5 years, I try to take about 6 months off, and I head to another system, mostly in the UK, because I enjoy the common humour and the banter and working with the paramedics in particular. And so it was a fantastic time for me, and I got to benchmark what we do. I got to take away the good, the bad, the ugly, and you always take away more good things than you think are bad. So, and it was I had a spectacular time.
That's fantastic, Steve. Fantastic. And like you said, there's real strength in comparison and just learning new systems, seeing how different people do things. So so what I'm really interested in just from you, Steve, is not only your background, but just looking at the high acuity response units as an analogue of what we do within the advanced paramedic system and where we aspire to be. So, Steve, could you just maybe illustrate a little bit of the background as to why sort of the Harrow service was set up and how they differentiate from maybe the intensive care paramedics?
Yeah, sure. So high acuity response unit is a very small number of our more senior critical care paramedics. So we run essentially a two-tier system. Our advanced care paramedic crews, which are about 92%, which they are probably at the level of your paramedics in the UK. You know, it's here and there, a little bit different. But and then our critical care paramedics would be similar to the critical care paramedics, advanced paramedic practitioners in London. They do some things that you perhaps may not do, and you do some things that they don't, but are fairly equivalent. And then sitting on top of that is a third tier. And essentially that's in the southeast of our state, where there's two-thirds of our state's population. And we don't put... we wanted to provide exactly the same level of care that our... It's almost a inverse equity of access that our helicopters provide, our doctor paramedic in general. We want to provide the same level of care within the urban setting, where in fact the vast majority of your trauma is. It's much more. We have lots of trauma in Australia at distance, and that poses very significant challenges for us and for our patients. But we felt there's a lot of trauma that could be addressed inside our urban areas. We looked at a lot of the data coming out of conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's probably the only good thing that happens out of wars is that we progress trauma care and rehabilitation. And looking around the world, thought, how could we construct a system that could work? And initially it was physician-led up until about 2013. I think I was doing about 2,000 jobs. No, there were 2,000 jobs a year, and I was doing about 1,300 to 1,400 of them. Yeah. And the boss said to me, I need a medical director, not a super paramedic, which should be seen as a compliment rather than someone trying to take their job. Yeah. And so we wanted to move from a physician-led system to a physician-mentored system. And so that's what we did. We moved from that the paramedics became the clinical leads. We still take a couple of senior registrars, which are generally post-fellowship. They're very senior. We have two or three with us at any one time. But 60 to 70% of the shifts, the paramedic is the leader. and they're a third tier, and they tend essentially what you would think from your HEMS would go to in the UK. Yeah. But instead of calling it isolated to major trauma in the urban areas, we went to high acuity response unit because we recognised that there are certain subgroups of intracerebral catastrophes, post-ROSC patients, very complex overdoses. We won't go to someone who's GCS7 and taken a tricyclic overdose. They should be able to be managed by a critical care paramedic. But we will go to that same patient if they're having significant dysrhythmias, they're seizing, they've got profound aspiration. And generally the CCP cohort will call our team in. I think it is has been a very successful transition. Probably they have the same clinical scope that our physician-led teams would be, bar thoracotomy at this point. But our requirement for thoracotomy, especially when you analyse it, we're very strict on 10 minutes of loss of vital signs for our penetrating trauma. And that's very hard, no matter what system you end up actually be there. We've had one successful survivor. Here, but we probably only do somewhere between 5 and 10 a year. We very much limit them. We're very fortunate not to have as much knife crime as the UK, but it is still significant enough. And so we think we've got the scope right, and we have an excellent team, and we rejuvenate it from time to time, and they perform very well.
Awesome. That's fantastic, Steve. Fantastic. And we were just talking about scope of practice, and we can drill down into that in a second. But something, you know, we were saying before is it's almost knowing as much about when not to perform a procedure as you were saying is when it is to perform a procedure. And it's about selecting the right patient cohort as to when actually maybe that patient needs to be in hospital with a certain procedure. But actually, and you know, the real differentiator for me has been, and I've heard this from you in the past, is learning when and when not to perform that procedure for the benefit of the patient. But which brings me quite nicely onto the scope of practice that you guys are practicing. So you guys are performing pre-hospital anaesthetic within the Harrow service, and also giving pre-hospital blood. Are you giving any sort of procoagulants such as fibrinogen and or TXA with the blood?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, we use obviously TXA. We do have plasma, yeah. And we also carry fibrinogen concentrate. Yeah. And we have some set indications for that. And we do some point of care testing with INR. And there's certainly patients that we know that, look, what is definitive care? For the whole idea about HARU in terms of trauma was not to be a travelling RSI kit. It was to actually provide some clinical leadership to what are infrequent complex presentations for most paramedics. And so really, to a certain extent, I know this might sound a bit controversial, I think the vast majority of people with very severe head injuries, the die's been cast. Yes, we try to prevent secondary brain injury, and that's what we should be doing. And I'm not saying we shouldn't address that. There are some incremental improvements if we treat them very well. But what we are really looking for is the awake, critically bleeding patient. And they are the people that we see now survive who just didn't survive as little as 5-10 years ago. And what we're trying to do is identify them really quickly. And if that's all we do, that's very important, because really now those patients, the patients who need express routes through the operating room are quite infrequent. You know, we have a lot of people who are bleeding and will go to the operating room, but to go through within 15 minutes. And so if we can do that and risk stratify those patients for our receiving trauma centres, they now will act on that. They'll have the theatre open 24 hours a day ready for us. And it's very unusual for one of those patients not to transit through either directly on the ambulance stretcher to the operating room or within 15 minutes. And if it's more than 15 minutes for one of them, a lot of questions get asked. And we'll ask those questions because we're trying to do our bit as well. And I think pre-hospital care can really drive performance at hospitals the same way that they drive our performance by asking us in order. So we think it's a very synergistic, and what we've been able to achieve is very close working relationships with our trauma centre. So when we move from a physician model to a paramedic-led model, the receiving hospitals really didn't care who did the RSI or who did the thoracostomy or who, you know, did the ultrasound, because they knew that they would be really quality assured within an inch of their life, the paramedics, and they can probably tell you that. But they were worried about the information flow because they'd been really used to very senior clinicians ringing up and saying, hey, I've got a problem. This is what I need. I'll be there in 7 minutes. And they just would act on it. We've had people, and it's like ultrasound. See, they do RSI. They do all the standard. They do advanced sedation and procedural sedation. Surgical thoracoscopy, intercostal catheter insertion. Very aggressively use ultrasound. Mainly for fast, to be quite honest. There's a lot of other things you can use it for, but we try to tailor it for how it's going to make a difference. Obviously blood product delivery. Anyone who gets more than 500 mils of saline, I have a conniption. And really, most people should need 100 mils to flush drugs through. And then if we're going to resuscitate someone, we go straight to blood products. Yeah. But the reality is most of them don't need any resuscitation whatsoever. And so our ICUs have seen significant reductions in our acute lung injuries and a whole bunch of other things. So that's our main trauma scope of practice. But the ultrasound is a very interesting one. It has to be quality assured because even in a really high performance team, there's a tendency for people to try and find things. Yeah. And if you cry wolf for your trauma centers, they are not going to trust you. So now essentially the only thing the surgeons want to know is what did the ultrasound show? Because, and a negative one's important to us as well. So if you've got someone who you think has got retroperitoneal hemorrhage and they're going to negative fast and profoundly shocked, and you can say it's not in the chest, it's not peritoneal bleeding, and it's not other blood loss, it's only one place it's going to be. So IR is going to be lit up before we get there. And they're going to have an idea to have it lit up. Whereas you've got the person who's unstable despite blood transfusion and positive fast, there's only one place they're ever going to go. Most of the time, they could go to IR as well, but they'll go to the Raptor suite. We can really change the dynamic, and especially if you see a positive fast within the first 15 minutes of injury, they are bleeding to death, and they are the ones that those patients when they used to rest in the emergency department only went one place, they died. Because you get a vicious circle of trying to get vital signs to get to theatre and various other things. So if we can get them to the operating room, we've seen this quite a few times now, and they rest as we arrive in the operating suite or shortly after arrival, they survive because they are there. And shaving off that 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes somewhere along their journey is actually absolutely critical. That's a healthy ethos anyway. Yeah. But it's time for definitive care. And definitive care starts with the bleeding patient. It's not just getting them to the surgeon's knife. When they get to the surgeon, we want them to be as optimized as possible en route. And that means providing them with adequate, appropriate filling, not overfilling them. And that's a whole thing to itself when you don't do it in people who are critically bleeding. And then addressing their coagulation as best we can. And if we can do that, it should optimize the outcomes. And that's what we hope to show. And there's a few studies going on.
That's fantastic, Steve. That's absolutely fantastic, and like I said, it's about shaving those minutes off and those incremental gains. Absolutely, that's fantastic, Steve. So just something you mentioned there around your sort of your audit, and we spoke before about this sort of three-tier audit because, like you said, in a highly governed system like yours, it's performing consistently well across domains. It's good to have oversight of that. And as you were saying, so there's sort of like an immediate audit, a 24-hour audit, and then a cold audit a little bit further along the line. Is that right?
Yeah. So initially, look, it's funny that our highest level clinical care practitioners actually ring up about pretty much every case, and they'll talk to a senior clinician, so 3 out of 5 weeks if it's me, and then the other 2 weeks it's spread across a number of other of our ex-registrars who are now more senior consultants, been going long enough in the trauma systems, and we'll discuss the cases. And it's not a permission type thing, it's two colleagues talking. And remembering, the HARU team is usually one paramedic who turns up with it, and there'll only always be another critical care paramedic on scene and some advanced care paramedics, so it's a single practitioner. And basically, they will present the case. What our expectation at that point is that they present their clinical findings and what they want to do. And in general, it's a pretty quick conversation. We try to get it done in under 2 minutes. It should be less than that, well less than that. And And normally I'll say, yeah, that sounds fine. We'll talk about the induction doses. We don't work on formulas of 3-2-1. We work on nuancing the induction to the patient. And sometimes we have a discussion whether we should intubate or not. Because if you've got someone who's profoundly bleeding, you may well cause, you know, maybe the best place to induce their anesthesia is in the operating room. And so, but sometimes you get put into a corner. So they're very subtle points about when to optimize. So we'll talk about that very quickly, get it done pretty quickly. If the pattern doesn't add up or the paramedic is a bit confused, then we'll FaceTime in to the scene. And sometimes with our, particularly our major burns, like you can avoid a lot of intubations on, the more experienced you are, the less people you intubate with significant burns. So we go, what I talk, go to a very significant, greater than 80% burn on average once every 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So very, but there's other burns that happen in that time. And we try not to intubate. Obviously that group, that patient's going to get intubated, I imagine, but for very anaesthetized, you're concentrating on the tube, but anaesthetized for whatever reason. And we try to, and sometimes you'll talk to the patient down the line. We try to minimize the FaceTime type thing because it upsets temporal flow.
Yeah.
And you really need the paramedics to keep the scene moving. But every so often you'll look at it, you know, there's one the other day where they were describing someone who was quite tachypneic, but was holding their own. And I just said, can I look at the patient? And I had a look and I said, no, I think we should anaesthetize him early because I think he's going to fall off the perch and we'll be well behind the eight ball. Let's do it while we've got a little bit of reserve up our sleeve. And that's what we did. And it turned out he had a lot of very significant injuries and he was a bit precipitous later on in his care at hospital. But the we don't knee jerk into it. So that's that first one. And then we do a case debrief afterwards. I'll let, you know, sometimes that's just by text. Sometimes I'll always know it's a problem when suddenly a photo comes down the line and I look at the photo on my phone and I go, oh my God, I'm about to get a call. That doesn't look very good. If they're trying to set the scene. Yeah. And we have ways of logging these photos and videos and various other things into secure databases and various other things. And they're often used by police later on and stuff. But the but we'll do debrief the case initially. And then the team will fill in a database. In that database is obviously the normal history and the like, and some of the KPIs that we're looking for. The code summary will go in there.
Yeah.
All the ultrasounds will go in there. We're very fortunate that our hospitals support us putting radiology into the secure database. And so within 24 hours, if I'm not the person I'm calling, if I am, I'll see the chest x-ray. I'll look at where our ET was placed, make sure they put an orogastric pin. And then I can look at the ultrasounds, make sure the reads are good. And then look at the other, often sometimes the radiology downstream. And it's good for my learning, my professional development, and then I know where we're going to go to an audit. And then at audit, we'll do the same thing. We also record any conversations. And I know sometimes at the audit later on, I'll say, you didn't tell me that. And I'll say, I did tell you. I'll say, you didn't, so we'll throw it at the tape.
Yeah.
And, of course, most times they did tell me and I just can't remember. But it is actually important. You can talk about being able to convey information very quickly, accurately, both to the hospitals. Like I don't want them spending, you know, I want them to hang up from the hospitals if they ask too many questions, because really any major trauma center worth its worth can set up based on, you know, a 30-second conversation. And so we will, and that's been helpful, you know, when we've had cases where people have told us we haven't told them things and various other things and times. And so we can track it back. We've got systems that I can, within 0.1 of a second, look at all the cars where they were at the time.
Yeah.
You know, 2006. I'm pretty lucky. We've got some good technical systems in the service. So, you know, off my iPad. So we can do really good quality assurance. And that's every 2 weeks. That's enough. I think I mentioned that we don't do any moulaging. We do during the induction for our paramedics. And we certainly go back to the cadaver labs, you know, two or three times a year. But outside of that, it's inside their heads that the moulage occurs because they get enough work, and this audit process works for us, and we find that they see or hear about all these different types of cases that, when, pardon my French, when the shit hits the fan and there's a real chance to decompensate, they just think back to what do we discuss at audit, what did I see John Smith do here? What did Steve Rashford do there? What did they suggest? What did they discuss? And it all spits out, and they seem to do an amazing job. It doesn't mean that cases don't go wrong. And, you know, like there's not as, you know, this is for the English audience, mostly there wouldn't be a team in the Premier League that wins the entire season. And so you're going to have some losses, and it's important you learn from your losses. But I think the most important ones are the games that you win ugly, where things just didn't go right, but you're able to win. And I think that, if I use the analogy for cases that I think that I'm most proud of, are where the team have, the paramedics and some, and our registrars, have dug themselves out of a hole and come through with the goods. It may not have been pretty, but they got there. And but luckily enough, the vast majority of cases fly through to the keeper quite well. And, you know, we're nitpicking when we look at them, you know, giving them 9 out of 10, and that's how we get that extra point.
Yeah.
That's the way it works. Yeah. And it's supposed to be confronting and fun at the same time.
Absolutely, Steve, absolutely. And something we were just talking about prior to now, prior to this conversation, was just around modelling vulnerability, but modelling your own failures. You know, you were saying sometimes you'll present a case that you didn't think that went that well, or that you think you could have done better. But what that does is, and what I really like about that is, it really sets the expectation. It's okay to model failure. It's okay to showcase failure, because we all get it wrong. And it probably gives other people permission to then step up with their with their failures.
Yeah, I think that's really important. It doesn't matter what type of clinician you are, or where you work in the health system, you have to recognise that you are not going to be perfect every time. And what, you know, all systems with quality assurance want, and quality improvement want, is engaging clinicians. So it's not healthy to be in the fetal position in the corner, rocking after a case that's gone wrong. It is actually appropriate to be remorseful if you think that your performance either contributed to an adverse event or didn't do as well as they could have. But as long as you channel that remorse and that reflection and that review into something positive, and I think as a team leader, and it's important to say, look, you know, and often if I'm leading the audit, I'll try and find a case that I've gone to that perhaps, or a consultation that I've spoken to the paramedic over the phone to, where I think I haven't performed anywhere near where I probably should have, and presenting that case front up to say, look, not that we want everyone to fail, well, it's not a fail, but, you know, but it's important to model that we're all in this together. And look, if you've been around long enough, there's not a complication you haven't had. I see my role, and as it goes down the line, the various levels of paramedic, critical care paramedics, advanced care paramedics, and our student paramedic, you know, that comes through the university, is to actually prevent someone else making the same error that you've made. But sometimes you have to make those errors, as long as they're not catastrophic errors, to actually make you a better clinician. Because if you haven't done that, you can't learn. And when it really does, and they're all learning experiences. You know, and I'm a bit old-fashioned, I must admit. I gave one of the registrars a bollocking the other day down the phone, because he probably deserved it. I only got 2 guys at the moment, so that's but it's over and done with in 30 seconds, because it was not the best of decisions. But you don't get into these high-performance teams unless you're really good. So if you're giving someone a thing, you're saying, look, I'm disappointed in you because you are far better than this. Mm. How do we get to this point? How did you make that decision? Let's just never make it happen again, eh? And just learn from it. And then I'll tell them a story about how I made the same decision at some stage, probably multiple times. And then everyone gets humbled every 3 to 6 months,
yeah,
depending on how busy you are.
Yeah.
And you say, I'll never do that again. And it happens. Yeah. But it's how you learn and try and stop that. So, you know, I guess what I'm saying is we're not that airy-fairy system. We're a system that expects high performance in this hard routine, but with that comes tremendous satisfaction at being part of that team. And we try to model good behaviour to our critical care paramedics, our advanced care paramedics, to say that this is how we should behave. And teamwork is the, and you know, you were talking about the SAS and high performance police arm teams and the like. Generally, their job is to actually amplify and empower the people around them not to be the people who are all guns blazing in general. And that's the same with Haru. Their job mostly is to actually empower the critical care and the advanced care paramedics. And when you go, I love it. I'll go out to a job and I'll stand back and I'll watch the Haru and I'll watch the CCPs. And in fact, the greatest thing I like watching are advanced care paramedics whose standards ultimately lift through all this. And because what I know is before the critical care paramedic or the Haru paramedic arrives, those advanced care paramedics now are right on song. And they are predicting those people who need RSI. They're predicting that they're looking for the burden of injury. They're looking for surgical emphysema. They're not listening to chest. They're looking at how someone's breathing. They're feeling the chest. They're making the diagnosis. And the stethoscope, you know, is a confirmatory thing if you believe in it. But most of it's already been done. And that's what we should be trying to do. And that's how we lift our standards.
Yeah. Yeah, Steve, that's fantastic. That's absolutely fantastic. So just shifting pace slightly, we use point of care ultrasound in London. I mainly use it for differentiation of sort of PAs, pseudo PA or true PA or in cardiac arrest. I use it for difficult vascular access as well. You guys are using it quite a lot for blunt abdominal trauma and fast scanning. Is that right? How are you then utilizing that knowledge through to the trauma center?
Sure. Look, well, we think it's absolutely, like I sort of alluded to it earlier, it's part of our risk stratification. So if you ring up a major trauma center, so I've got someone with blunt or penetrating trauma and they've got a heart rate of 130, and I think they've got these injuries, they'll actually say, all right, are they going to be a responder? Is that someone going to go CT? Is that going to blah, 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 blah? Do I really need the chief here? Can I be the surgical fellow? Can all that, you know, everyone has high tier responds and, you know, in the hospital. But if you can add another piece of information to it, that will often give them a much, that risk stratifies them. So if you say, I've got someone who's got a blood pressure of 90, they've got a heart rate of 130 and has got a wildly positive fast and is deteriorating despite resuscitation, inevitably that's a super high risk candidate. Now, they would have called a full trauma team anyway, but they're just galvanized. And it's how you save minutes. It is how you, these people go through. We call them red blankets. They, if you look at Camp Bastion, it used to be turn left or turn right, whichever way it was. You know, they get a red, literally, it wouldn't work in London with your red blankets, but they literally get a red blanket out of the drawer put on them by the ED consultant or the surgical consultant, and then no one can touch the patient. They go to the operating room. No one's allowed to put a catheter in. No one's allowed to put an art line in. They just move. The nurses are really aggressive at putting it through and pushing us along. That it's how you shave those times off, and they absolutely move along. So, and a negative ultrasound can also do it in penetrating trauma. We diagnose that tamponade well before they get to hospital, and. Again, you know, there are lots of people stabbed in the chest, lots of people, but you can actually de-escalate the whole system. If you've got someone who's relatively well with multiple stab wounds and you whip an ultrasound over them, most times you'll say, oh, well, it's all fine. It doesn't mean that doesn't mean they haven't got an injury, right? It doesn't mean they haven't got an injury, but a significant injury, but they're not in that group. They're going to need to go through the operating room really quickly. And there's subtle presentations. You know, there's a lad that was, you know, you see the odd person who has a relatively negative subxiphoid view with a big left, normally left-sided hemothorax, and they haven't got a cardiac wound. But we pick those. We'll say, look, there's just a little bit of blood there in that pericardial space, and they've got a big left hemothorax. We're worried about a cardiac wound that's decompressed into the left chest. And that sets the scene for our, and they're done on the run. Yeah. You know, often we really encourage our responding critical care paramedics and advanced care paramedics not to wait on scene. Haru, about half or, 60% of the time we will meet en route. We aim to do all our stuff in under 8 to 10 minutes on the side of the highway or the side of the thing, because if the person needs the intervention, they do. But for these stabbings, what will happen is you'll be waiting on the side of the road, you'll have the ultrasound already open, the probe, everything, and you'll plan that they'll stop. It's a bit like going into a pit crew at in the Formula One. One of the paramedics will hop out, which will ultimately take the Haru car. The Haru paramedic will hop on with their blood and the like, and they'll take off again straight away. and I do the ultrasound en route.
Yeah, so there's no time lost. It's just synchronous. It just one to the and then,
that's what we aim for. It's not always perfect, and sometimes we spend too much time, and we talk about that. But that's what we should be aiming for. If we know someone's coming along with major trauma, who the CCP's picked, they probably should have an RSI. Our expectation is they've already done the kit dump inside the ambulance, and we should just come along and do a very quick checklist with them. But all our CCPs carry our checklists in their airway kits.
That's fantastic. So there's crossover. So other paramedics have checklists. That's fantastic, Steve.
And then they will have done it. And so it means that you can, and that's just about speeding up. And then they'll have the drugs drawn up because they're all carrying ketamine anyway. Generally we use ketamine, fentanyl, rock uranium. And that's what we've done since about 2010. We got rid of SUCS then, in 2010. And so we'll use some propofol and fentanyl in the setting of our medical RSIs, and then a bit of everything, depending on what we think the patient needs. But it's about having those systems to try and keep moving in. And so time and definitive care, my rough guide is 1 of our minutes is worth about 2.5 at hospital.
That's fantastic. Yeah, that's fantastic.
That's in terms of, because if we do watch, very few people say, let's watch how long they take to anesthetize that patient. Inevitably, someone wants different doses of drugs and this, that, and the other. And look, sometimes it's very slick, but most times, and we should be slicker at it because it's what we do. If we can't get this right, then we should give up. And so our checklists have permeated into the hospital system. Just like we drove the cardiologist crazy with our 12 lead ECGs and referrals for PCI, and that drives service delivery, we've driven the trauma surgeons crazy by presenting them patients now that they've never seen before. And they don't all survive, but we do get unexpected survivors. And as long as you're not being overly heroic or cowboyish or cowgirlish, whatever you want to say, and you're doing it in reasonable fashion, then that's fine. And that's what we should be doing.
Yeah, Steve, that's fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. Something of revelation to me really is, and something I can really take from this conversation is just having all that information together. So in a debrief, albeit a cold debrief, having the ultrasound, having the ECG, having the code summary, having the x-rays, having everything, some of the follow-up as well in that database to then put a real sort of chronological cross-section of the job from start to finish is fantastic, because then, like you said, you can dissect decisions as to whether they were the right decisions, maybe the wrong decisions, but it's that learning process, that corporate learning process from having all the information in front of you, which I think we're aspiring to be like that, because it's that really gives you way more of the full picture of their journey through the system.
And having trauma surgeons in the room too, like we're very fortunate that where possible, I can't always get there, but the directors of trauma at our major hospitals will try and attend the audit when they can, and that's gold. Mm. It's gold both ways.
Yeah.
What it does is we get this amazing closure of the loop for us, and they're very good to us. In fact, they are very kind to us. But it's actually really important for them, because they get to hear about these cases that often it gets diluted along the line, and they understand them. We all have a really good fundamental understanding of the mechanism of injury and the way our trauma patients change. I think, it doesn't matter what level paramedic you are. If a paramedic asks me, what's the role of a paramedic? No matter what's wrong with the patient, you should be working out what's their current status now. Nothing should be a surprise to you.
Yeah.
Every so often you get someone that does surprise you, but most people, it's predictably unpredictable or predictably predictable. Where are they going to be in 15 minutes? Where are they going to be in 60 minutes? And I think our paramedics should think, where are they going to be in 120 minutes and 6 hours down the track? Because when you're thinking about that, you tailor your interventions and you tailor what you do, how you light the system up, And that's the role of a paramedic. The paramedic's not just about, it's a nice surrogate measure to get to the hospital alive. You're not, don't, trust me, you know, I'm not against that. But it's really, really important to think about what the trajectory of this patient is. And if they're not following the trajectory that you envisage for them, you have, that should be like a red warning, you know, like the oil pressure warning for the pilot. I've got a system now. I'm just going to go through my system and work through it. And that's what makes a really good clinician. There isn't magic to being a good clinician. Most people can do procedures. Most people do that. But putting it all together, understanding the burden of illness or the burden of injury, or whatever you want to say, and then working out what should happen.
Yeah.
Because, you know, every so often I know it sounds crazy, but you'll pick someone with an aortic transection because they behave in a funny way sometimes in certain circumstances and because they don't add up. And anyway, but yeah, so that's where we're trying to get our paramedics and our registrars and our other doctors.
That's fantastic. And to that point, Steve, I really agree with you because having interacted with sort of trauma surgeons and the like, what it does, it helps me reinforce how important my slice of the cake is, and then it helps you because you can see the bigger picture and you can see whether they survived and or not or what interventions they went on to have. It changes the game. It changes my decision making processes. Absolutely. knowing you're right, what's beyond my care, and I wholeheartedly agree with you. Having other clinicians involved in the debrief is probably a really powerful way to go, and certainly something we should institute, actually, because it's fantastic.
Yeah, we had a few burn surgeons come the other day, and we had a couple of, you know, very nasty incidents, which are but major burns are always very confronting. And when you have potentially multiple people with major burns at the same incident, and to have the burn surgeons in the room to just, you know, look, the reality is most of the care is actually quite, you know, simple, you know, following fairly simple tenets of care. But to understand where that burn resuscitation is going, which is the most difficult resuscitation, their first 24 hours are burn resuscitations to get right. But we recognise that what happens in the first 2 hours of a major burn injury will definitely affect a person's chances of survival and the morbidity that they may suffer as a result of that and their quality of life, their scarring. And so we have to be absolutely on song with our treatment. And whilst they're simple principles, getting them right is not that easy under certain circumstances. So to have those people in the room and to talk about, you know, what their expectations are and then never, you know, by having them part of your audit, I won't say they give us an easy time. They don't. They have high expectations of us. Trust me, I've taken some of the calls, usually about my patients. But they are friends, and they then contribute to our education and professional development activities more broadly in the ambulance service. We've developed up our own new burns formula, which is more accurate than anything that's been published, and hopefully be published soon, actually. But it's easy. It's so much easier than what's around. And so that was done by our burn surgeon saying, look, we were concerned about some of your estimations of weight and estimations of burn area and getting behind on fluids or getting over the top of fluids. And we said, all right, let's get the data. So we looked at the data together. One of my assistant medical directors, Dan Bodner, is a real boffin. And you can do things with pivot tables that I can only dream of. No, I don't dream about it. I just let him do it. And we analyzed the data, and what's been come up with is just what we're looking for is research which translates into changes in our practice and changes in our outcomes, not sort of esoteric research for no one's benefit. And so very simple stuff. And we think it has changed the way our paramedics are able to address these burn patients. But it's driven by a very collegiate response to it. Now, I'm not saying our system's perfect. I don't want people listening to think I'm saying, oh, Queensland's got the best system in the world, because we don't. I don't know who's got the best system in the world. I certainly don't believe people who tell you they do, because they're the last I want to hear. I remember having a Twitter war with someone about surgical airways, and they're telling us how many surgical airways they've done. And I think I might have tweeted to them and said, well, you're the last person I want to see on the end of an RSI, to be quite honest. I'm quite happy not to meet you.
Yeah.
Because, the people who puff out and do all that sort of stuff, right, go and do that. And you see a lot of that on Twitter. I think we just crack on and do the business, and it's for other people to judge, to be quite honest.
Yeah, Steve, absolutely. I think that's fantastic. Steve, just pivoting slightly and looking at some of the lessons that you've learned. I mean, fundamentally, I'm just learning through this, just, you know, bringing that plenary of clinicians together is a fantastic thing that I think we could benefit from and always have, actually. But lessons learned from you guys over the past 5 to 10 years, is there any sort of fundamental lessons that you feel you've taken forward through stewarding the sort of the, not necessarily just the HARU program, but the ICP program and broader into the ambulance service? One of the fundamental things that we advocate and preach is just doing the basics well and drilling down into the basics. And even if it's a mentorship role that we provide is around good airway management from some of the basics. I guess, has that been some of the prerequisites from something you guys have installed?
Absolutely. I think the role of your extended scope paramedics, whether they be critical care paramedics or whether they be HARU or advanced paramedic practitioners, whatever nomenclature you use, is their role is far more about, look, what's important is what is in between your ears at any level of clinician, no matter what you do. And as soon as a paramedic, you know, I value a paramedic who's cerebral far more than I value a paramedic who can put a cannula in someone who's got really difficult access, because that's the person who's cerebral will always save more lives. And often saving more lives has got nothing to do with the intervention. It's about recognizing these patients and recognizing what they need and where they need it, the time they need it. And so as you actually step up through the levels, and, you know, if we've got HARU, like sometimes, you know, initially some of them used to say, oh, I don't think it was a HARU job. But every job's a HARU job, because you're there to support other people, to empower them. And in fact, most times you should stand back. I rarely ever get in the back of a car that someone's trucking, mainly because I'm getting too fat in my old age. But it is because they've already got a paramedic there. They know what they're doing. Your job is to say, thumbs up, feel free to cope, I'll stand back, and just keep doing what you're doing. And later on, take them through the post-case debrief is so important about and recognizing good performance. I think, you know, that forever and a day, quality assurance has been about learning from cases that have gone wrong. We should be learning with as many good things about cases that have gone really well. And so, you know, one of the things, you know, more broadly the service is that we've got an electronic audit system, and we look for exemplary cases. And I'm not just talking about exemplary cases that, you know, someone's, you know, had a traumatic amputation or whatever. We look for things that just treating an elderly patient with dizziness well, and identifying, looking at the quality of their case notes and the like. And so the lesson I've learned is that it's about producing cerebral paramedics and engendering that the entire way back. When I say depth, backwards to the system, doesn't mean our advanced care paramedics, our baseline paramedics are more important. They are the engine room of the ambulance service, and it's so important for our... There's no point turning up to someone with a critical head injury or critical bleeding or post-ROSC if those basics and stuff haven't been done. But the way to engender that is to have a system of support and people, and, you know, not just picking up with saying that was great, we're going to learn from that, or that, you know, we should all learn from what happened there, in a very positive fashion. So I think that's the big thing. We see people who come into HARU who perhaps technically aren't as good as intubating as others, by the time they hit the road, they are, you know, achieving first pass rates of, you know, close to 97% for RSI. And part of that is what's going on between their ears. It's about performance management, setting them up to undertake things. Look, most paramedics who intubate are really good at intubating. Give me a dummy, even make it a difficult dummy, a mannequin, you know, a simulation model. But put them under immense pressure. And I use the example of golf. We were having a quick talk before. You know, the reality is there's lots of all the paramedics know I love golf. You know, golf, like there's not an analogy you can't do about golf and medicine, but, you know, there's lots of kids at the local golf course who can hit the ball further, probably straighter than Tiger Woods or, you know, one of the other good golfers. But none of them can do it when the pressure's really on, as well as Tiger or one of the other, you know, Phil Mickelson or, you know, one of the other, you know, Brooks Koepka, you know, one of the really good players. And that's the difference. And that's what we have to take people on to actually be able to do it under immense pressure. And then they perform. And it's just a way of life. So that's what we're trying to do. So that's something we've learned. We've learned in our system that endlessly moulaging doesn't always achieve the results, but endlessly looking at cases does, because it's interesting for people. And having that almost longitudinal audit on each case. And also having differences of opinion. You know, we have a few of my assistant medical directors and I, we often, they will challenge me as much as I challenge them. In fact, more so, they seem to take great joy in it. But and it's very important that that the paramedics see that as well. It's done in a respectful way. They're not saying, Steve, you're a hopeless clinician, I hope not. Why'd you do that? They're saying, well, come on, that's a bit out of the ordinary. Why did you do that? Or why did you give the advice that we should intubate? Because I don't think we needed to. Or, you know, and I think that's a really important thing that we have that we're not afraid of audit. We don't want pathologic audit, but it's okay to be robust, because this is, you know, if we want to do the stuff we want to do, you know, if you've got a system out there and you're going to be doing anesthetics on the sickest of the sick. I'm not talking about just someone who's got a, you know, not playing it down, someone who's got a barn door overdose or a barn door stroke, if you think, we know that's not the right thing to do anyway, but someone who's really, really either technically difficult or from a procedural perspective or from making the decision, should we do it at all, then you have to be really good at it. And one thing I will not accept, if you want to see me go bananas, apart from lots of crystalloid, it is tell me that it's so much more difficult in the pre-hospital environment, because that's a load of bullshit. If we're going to play in that environment, we have to be better than the hospitals, and that's what we should be striving for. And I'm pleased to report in many ways we are. In some ways we're not, and that's where we should be aiming, and sometimes we can drive change. And I get a great kick out of driving change in the hospital. If they want to mimic what we do, that's fantastic. They can rename the list, checklist, whatever they want to do, but it doesn't matter. It's really important for that. But we have to strive to be, because ultimately our patients deserve it. And there's no point playing these sort of games. This is high intensity medicine. If we're not up to the challenge, and that's what we should be, and that's what we should be striving to do.
Steve, that's fantastic. And like you said, just modelling that to other services or in hospital services, so that there's then ubiquity of kind of quality assurance. But you're right; it's almost the pinnacle of it needs to be in the pre-hospital environment, because you're right. It's hard, but that mandates us, like you said, even more to make sure not only what we're doing is safe, but also the right thing to do in the right environment. So optimization. And slowing it down to make sure that you've optimized everything if you are going to do it. Steve, that's fantastic, mate. That's absolutely fantastic. So just coming into land, Steve, because I know I'm mindful of taking your time for a good over an hour. Just looking at sort of the way forward, really, for you guys. Just as in QAS, but maybe in Haru, but just in critical care, so to speak. What do you see as the way forward in the short to midterm for you guys?
It's a really interesting question, because you know, if we look at the people who, and the way I use the example, if you they're almost double the percentage of patients who presented in defibrillatable rhythms 20 or 30 years ago, and And that's because the way we treat our cardiac patients means that they live longer. And when they finally have their cardiac arrest, they clap out into a non-shockable rhythm. And that means our whole patient cohort is a different cohort than it was 20 or 30 years ago. And it means that they are presenting in what appear to be low acuity presentations, but are often incredibly sick and very subtle presentations. And so the paramedic has to become more cerebral. You know, in all honesty, most courses, I reckon we could teach anyone to treat status epilepticus once they graduate, but I want them to have critical reasoning and critical assessment skills. And then we can take them on that journey. But in terms of critical, and this brings the frustration for our critical care paramedics, because if you look at the curves of expansion of scope, if you look at pure scope, our scope of practice for our baseline paramedics is has incrementally over a period of time rapidly come towards where our critical paramedics are. Mm. And some of our critical care paramedics get really frightened by that, because they define themselves by hand skills. And the reality is there is an immense difference between someone who is a critical care paramedic and done postgraduate study, done a master's, than someone who's done an undergraduate degree, whether they do the same technical procedures or not. And you should define yourself. So the secret for critical care paramedics for the future is that they are the live mentors. And look, they're always going to have a wider scope of practice. It may not be as wide as what people think and want, because, you know, we have to look at cost effectiveness and changes and the like. But they are going to have a role of mentoring. And instead of changing the outcome of one patient, they change the outcome of hundreds and thousands of patients over their careers by influencing their more junior colleagues junior colleagues. So that's the future. I think I'm vexed by ultrasound. I don't know how to roll it out more widely and maintain the high quality. The issue is, as soon as we take away from our quality, we will lose traction at hospitals. Mm. It's taken a long time to build that up. You start giving them false reads, particularly, and most people overread them. You know, we have a thing that you're not allowed to say there's a sliver. We might say it at audit.
Yeah.
They're either positive or they're negative.
Yeah.
Then we don't tell them they're indeterminate, because at the worst, that's not going to be the patient that's going to cause you problems if they've got a little sliver there of blood. And for the trauma ones anyway. And so that strikes me. How can this is a more localized issue. How do we roll Haru out more broadly? At the moment, we have one Haru car, which covers about 2.5 million people. And then we have another one, which covers 600,000. And then the other population centers are much less than that. Do we do a Haru-like model, but still bring them into our quality assurance loop and have the mothership that they come back to and do the original training, then pop out and come back, you know, a couple of days. But do the audits where, you know, COVID, we've got one Haru-like spot already planned, and since COVID, they're on team. They're 1,800 kilometres away from us, so what's that, you know, 1,100 miles away, and they're participating in our audit by teams and seeing all the same radiology and the like. So there's a lot of stuff how we take that on there, and I guess assessing what we do and being prepared if our data shows that our data shows that we shouldn't be transfusing. And we already have. We've started to reduce the number of people we transfuse. When you've got blood, it's very easy to use it. If that data suggests that we shouldn't be doing it, we should be able to be good clinicians and understand that we should stop something and not be afraid to do that. And then something else probably pops up. Everyone likes, you know, procedures and doing stuff. I know that. And that's why you're in this sort of high-end, the high-acuity part of medicine. But we can't have it both ways. And I think it's developing up that maturity. But the big thing is just making all of us more cerebral in our practice, I think, is where we need to be.
Yeah, Steve, that's fantastic. That's absolutely fantastic, mate. And just like you said, just that mentoring and pastoral role and support, and then dissemination of information, and like I said, of of critical thinking is exactly where I think a lot of services and schemes want to be, and certainly where we want to be as well. So that's absolutely fantastic, Steve. And I think that's there's some real nuggets of pearls of wisdom in there. So I really appreciate just not only your time today, but just your thoughts and perspectives. It's been fantastic.
Thanks, Alan. I really appreciate it. And look, I wish you all the best. We've watched our colleagues in the UK. COVID for us has been a little bit different. We've been very fortunate by a lot of decisions they've made have drastically reduced the case numbers here. And whilst we've had to have all the preparation and the thinking behind it all, we've been very fortunate in the numbers. But we've watched on with you and your colleagues have done an amazing job. And we wish you the continued best for that. And I mean that. It's been hard to watch all around the world for those areas that have really been struck down by it. But we're all one team. We all learn. We've learned a lot. We've been very fortunate to be an island a long way away. And with our colleagues in New Zealand, and hopefully we can continue to learn. But our best wishes are with you, and keep up the good work. You know, the LAS is just a, I'm being specific to where you work, but it is just an outstanding service. And between them and London Hems, and all the other services over there, we always look to see. We're fundamentally criminals, aren't we? Out here, so we're very happy to steal stuff, and we'll continue to see if I can steal some more stuff off you if I can.
Oh, you'd be more than welcome. It's always a pleasure, Steve, and like you said, it's been a real honour for me to grow up within a system and have people like you, you know, to interact with. But throughout the 20 years, just really see everything that London has had to throw at me. Mm-hmm. So it's been a real pleasure, Steve. And you're right, we're all on that learning journey together. So it's definitely it's more cohesive when we're sharing information between each other.
Good on you.
But thanks, Steve, and we'll catch you soon.
Okay, cheers.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.